Start that again. I was just telling you about.
Yeah, I was just telling you about Joe Begley, about the chapter, having a chapter in Studs Terkel's book called Working, and that I happened to be in Atlanta when a play was being produced by a local theater group. And I didn't realize that one of the chapters that was being portrayed was about Joe, and the actor came out on the stage and he said, "My name is Joe Begley." And he went through this chapter and was very, very, it was really good. But then I was surprised to learn that a little bit later, there was another chapter from that same book about a man called Hartman Turnbow, who's from Holmes County, Mississippi, whom I knew. Hartman was an active voting rights activist. He was a local person who had started encouraging people to register to vote in Holmes County, Mississippi, where there had been a lot of discrimination, of course. And the Klan torched his house while he was there, and they turned around and arrested Hartman for arson, as though he were going to burn down his own house. And so we filed a case, the government, the United States filed a case in federal court to get him out of there and to try to prevent further intimidation in Holmes County, Mississippi, of voters. And so I had gotten to know Hartman. It was interesting. So on that particular evening, I saw both he and Joe Begley on the stage, because Hartman was black, very strong personality. For Joe Begley was a real hero in my book, and his wife, English teacher, got a master's from the University of Chicago, and of course, I knew their daughter who died, and her husband's still living and teaches at Hazard Community College and is a musician like you.
What's his name?
Oh, goodness gracious, you should not ask me names. I'll have to think about it.
I have to stop asking you names.
Janie was her name, and their daughter, is a dentist with a local comprehensive health program and is a wonderful woman who was the head of our health care task force on the SOAR project, which is this economic development effort that Hal Rogers, our congressman, and the former governor put together. But she's a very strong person, and we had hearings on the problems we have in this area with health care, or with the health of our community, of the health of our citizens. Big problems like diabetes are terribly. Her name was Nikki. What's Nikki's last name? Anyway, Nikki. We made a number of recommendations, way out, things like, why shouldn't you look more carefully at the incidence of cancer in mountaintop removal communities, and get the National Institute of Health to do some studies about that, because there's been a lot of at least anecdotal evidence, if not statistical evidence, that the cancer rates are higher in communities with mountaintop removal. Well, they didn't. That was something they weren't so keen to investigate, and they did not. And apparently, they asked her not. They replaced her as the head of our committee a little later. I mean, we made other more down to earth other recommendations that are more traditional about investigating the drug issues, the drug problems, and diabetes, and what are we going to do about diabetes? What are we going to do about the heavy rate of smoking in eastern Kentucky and things like that? But Nikki is a wonderful person, and she's Joe Begley's granddaughter. And her parents, I'll have to think about her the name of her father. Anyway, Joe organized a group called the Citizens League to Protect Surface Rights. And so many of our strip mining cases are efforts that we did beyond just representing people in individual cases. For example, we did in the name of the Citizens League to Protect Surface Rights. We filed many comments about water pollution, you know, strip mining and mining the runoff from mining from coal mines, both deep and surface mines, create a lot of water pollution. And so we were very involved in trying to get the Corps of Engineers to get this national pollution NPDES system out, and the stream to get meaningful water pollution controls involved, and took year after year after year to get them to move on that. And then we finally had the federal water pollution statutes that finally came out were somewhat helpful. But as you know, even they won't, they're trying to get reasonable regulations on mining has been difficult. Even getting the definition of waste, right, that coal mine, that refuse, or that the overburden from mining sites is called waste. It's not, right? There are exceptions for the Corps of Engineers. So, but we did a lot of those comments, because in the names of for the Citizens League to Protect Surface Rights, and that was a good thing. I think we were starting to talk about, so the three big areas on the related to coal that we have worked on and that we've continued to work on for the Appalachian Citizen Law Center are the disturbance of the land, the surface mining, strip mining, and that sort of thing. Mountaintop removal, which is more recent in eastern Kentucky, much has happened. It was earlier and much more on a larger scale initially in West Virginia, I think. And black lung and mine safety. And the mine safety, as I said, when we started getting into these cases and learning and getting complaints from coal miners who had complained about safety conditions in the coal mines, and then even though the federal statute protects coal miners who complain that they're not supposed to be discriminated against because they've complained about a safety condition. Many of our mines were non-union mines, or hardly, I don't think we have a union mine left today in eastern Kentucky. I'm not sure that there's one.
I don't know of any.
And there weren't any really private attorneys around to take those cases in eastern Kentucky. They're expensive to do. You got to have an expert witness. You need a good advocate. And so Tony kind of found himself doing more and more of that work.
Tony
Oppegard. Yeah, Tony Oppegard, whom you've interviewed when he was in Hazard. So we started getting a lot of those cases. I think as the word got out that we were Apple Red, primarily Tony, were willing to do those cases, and that we were starting to have some success. And when you read the description of those cases, the coal miners invariably had very good reason. Either there was loose top that they didn't want to get into, or we had one fella, I remember, who had got electrocuted by a trailing cable, and he told his boss about it and said, "I can't work under this." And he said, "No, yeah, you can." So then he got shocked the second time. He said, "You keep on." So he shopped, he got electrocuted again. He said, "I'm not going to work on this." They said, "Well, you can go home." So they fired him. Well, we represented him and we got his job back. And so the idea primarily in these cases was to try to get these folks their job back. We had a, and sometimes we did. And then when the legal services corporate, well, then what we did, Tony was, had been married, his wife was unable to find a good job in Hazard after over a couple of years, and we said, well, let's see. They considered moving to Lexington, and we decided that because we had so many of these cases, and maybe we could do some education around safety issues and get some help to organize to give some support to these coal miners that were in the area, that we would try to start a mine safety project as a separate project for Applerid and see if we could get some funding. Because I needed extra funding, because if Tony was going to do that only and we move it to Lexington, we need somebody to replace. I had to replace Tony and Hazard with another person. So we really needed some extra independent funding to get to set up the project. And so we applied. So when Tony moved to Lexington, we started applying to some foundations.
For mine safety.
For mine safety.
And how did you frame that, those requests? How did you frame it? What were the parameters?
The idea was that these coal miners were out of a job at that point and that they couldn't afford to represent a lawyer. A private attorney wasn't going to take it on any contingency. It was too remote, too difficult to represent. You need an expert witness very often in these cases, and you had to be an expert. You needed somebody like Tony. I could probably represent somebody, but to learn the mining technology and to be able to prove to really do a good job for this coal miner, you had to know what you're doing. So the parameters were trying to have enough funding to employ someone like Tony, or a lawyer and a secretary and space. And the first, I think, foundation to really come through for us was a foundation known as Steele Rees Foundation.
Steele
Rees, STEELE. And then REESE. And they have competitive grants in Appalachia, and we ended up having an interview with them. That becomes significant a little bit later. So they gave us a grant for a couple of years, and then we funded. We needed to keep writing, and we got some other foundation support. And Tony did that for, I think, 4 or 5 years, and then let me see if I got a note when Tony, let's see, when Tony went to, he began that, the Mine Safety Project began in 1991, so all the way in 1998, Tony went to Washington to work with David McAteer as a special assistant, when David was the head of the assistant secretary for mine safety in Washington. And then I said, well, we'll try to keep this project going, even in our individual offices, so people would continue getting representation. But I always thought it was difficult to find anybody of his expertise. We did continue to do some of these cases. Then when he came back, actually in 2001, Tony came back to Kentucky from Washington and became the general counsel under Paul Patton for the Mine Safety Commission, the Kentucky Mine Safety Commission. He was going to prosecute cases of miners in front of our state commission. So that's sort of his career, but we kept doing these cases. When I started to retire, what happened was that the Steele Rees Foundation, the person who was interviewing for them, one of their trustees, or two of their trustees, whose name, again, I can't remember at the moment, but he passed away. He died. But each year, at the end of the year, I usually send out this letter I was telling you about, the end of the year fundraising letter that sort of describes in a page or two what Applerid did, and why we need more money, need donations. His widow continued getting those letters. And in 2001 or two, out of the clear blue sky, she called me and said, John, I've been reading this letter, your letters, and I'm thinking that we might have a little extra money. And if we had some money and could offer, what would you do with the money? And I said, well, if we had enough money, what I'd really like to do is start another public interest law firm without government funding, but that we got enough money to support two or three lawyers from year to year who could do this important work, like our mine safety and voting work, about our mine safety and our strip mining work and our black lung work, without having to worry about where the money's coming from next year. Because if you try to do it as a private a law firm, it's just too expensive. You're doing fender benders and representing people every day, and you just can't do that way. And if you're in a government firm, like the way we have now, where legal service is a wonderful program and serves a lot of important needs for poor people, but it's very hard to also do the mine, to do this other work, and we now have all these restrictions.
Because it's unaffordable or because it's too controversial?
Well, it's not, part of it's controversial, but at that point, we had these restrictions on lobbying, for example. If we wanted to go to the Kentucky legislature and lobby for mine safety conditions or for different black lung work. And we were no longer, at that point, there was a prohibition on legal services programs for getting attorney fees. If we won a case, and even if it was a court-awarded fee, for example, when Tony was doing these cases, our primary objective was to get the first was to get the coal miner his or her job back. A few of these people were women. Well, one of the negotiations, we would usually say, we're going to represent this coal miner and we're going to take it all the way to court and we're going to win the case. And when we win the case, you're going to have to pay us attorney fee for our time. It doesn't come out of the coal miner's pocket. It's a court-awarded fee if we get to that point. Might be a year or two down the line. But if you're willing, if you look at the merits of the case and you're ready to put this coal miner back to work, we're not going to take any attorney fee from you. So that was that was important leverage. Well, we lost that leverage when the Legal Services Corporation, when Congress put these restrictions on us. In 1996, Congress added a series of restrictions on legal services, and primarily the attorney. Another restriction was a class action. You could no longer file class actions because controversial. It just sounded like something private attorneys could do. They just didn't want you to do what they wanted you to do was represented. They were willing to let you represent individuals in family law cases, in day-to-day kinds of cases that weren't going to upset the apple cart or, you know, put public officials on the chopping block, or that would be precedent-setting cases that were important. When class actions are actually very efficient, instead of having to file a whole bunch of individual cases, you file one case, and if they change the policy, you know, Social Security, whatever it is, policy applies to everybody, but they put in a prohibition against that. Now, the attorney fee thing was actually, this is 2016, 2 or 3 years ago, 10, 12 years later, they finally got the attorney fee provision it's okay, legal services can once again get court-awarded fees. Now, that's not a fee out of the client's pocket. But anyway, all of those restrictions together were and in the black lung cases, what we were doing at that time and still do, the federal black lung cases are very time-consuming cases. And they take years. And then if the coal miner wins, oftentimes the appeal by the coal company appeals every case. And so when you... And even though in those few instances where the coal miner wins, if he wins, they can go ahead and get their benefits, but the appeal goes on and on and on. So you might get an attorney fee 10 years later. I mean, some of these cases take a long, long time. So we did get attorney fees in those cases. And again, that prohibition, again, in the black lung cases, stopped us from getting any more fees. So that was part of my motivation in trying to get something separate. And I was pretty close to retiring from Apple Red. And so this very nice lady, Pat Davidson, who's one of two trustees for this foundation called the Bingham Fund. If we do this publicly, they don't like to get their names involved very much. It's just a small foundation. They don't take any proposals for applications. They just call when they want to, and they set their priorities. So they gave us, I think, a couple of $100,000 to start. And so we set up an office around the corner from here, from Prestonsburg, from our main office, and moved basically the coal-related Appleridge work to the what we then started called the Appalachian Citizens Law Center. Still, the name hasn't changed, but we moved our work, the coal-related work, there. And my litigation director here, Steve Sanders, became the co-litigation director at the time, became the director of that. He wanted to do that. He became the director here in Prestonsburg. And two of the lawyers from here moved over at that time. One of them had been a fellow, always on a fellowship. And so we started this Appalachian Citizens Law Center to do that coal-related work. And we are now in our, next year will be our 15th year. And so we've been fortunate in getting grants. Now, the black lung work during this time, I should go all the way back from the beginning. We were talking earlier about Bill Worthington. I mean, besides the broad form deed, now Joe wasn't as much, Begley wasn't much into black lung work, but we had people like Bill. And at that time, you know, the black lung bill was signed in 1969 as part of the Federal Coal Mine Health and Safety Act after the Farmington disaster. It was one of the few, it still is the only federal occupational bill that provides compensation for a breathing impairment, Bill Worthington breathing impairment, or any other occupational disease. There's no other bill like it. The problem is, when they first got it going, for the first few years, the regulations that were issued and the criteria they used were so difficult that the coal miners couldn't get their benefits. Most of them, they were approving 1 or 2% of the claims. So when I came in 1970, they were having hearings. The coal miners, the union miners, and a non-union miner, everybody was upset because they passed this nice bill primarily through a lot of the work of our own congressman, Carl Perkins, who was the head of the Education and Labor Committee at that time. He was very much in favor and did this to get this bill passed. And so in 1972, because these coal miners protested so strongly about what had happened, they amended the bill, the 69 bill, and they created some presumptions and made it and liberalized the program quite a bit. And so that was 1972, but they also added a provision, I think, whether it was the original bill that in 1973 or 4, the entire program would be taken away from Social Security and be turned over to the Labor Department, and the Labor Department would deal with it much like a workers' compensation program. And the difference is, during the early years, especially through 1972, when they relaxed these benefits, you go to the black lung, getting your black lung was like getting Social Security. You went to the local office, you applied. If you had a hearing, you went by yourself or with a friend. There was no lawyer on the other side from the coal company. Once the Department of Labor got this thing to be like workers' compensation, at the hearing, there was the coal miner and his representative, his lawyer, and also the coal company with the coal company's lawyer. So it became much more difficult again to get approved. They're approving like 7% of the claims. This went on for several years. And so during this period, we started doing these federal black lung hearings. The private bar in Kentucky was doing only state workers' compensation claims. A few lawyers were doing federal claims, but they took so long and they were so few that they were being approved. So anyway, again in 1978, after all the complaints about how long it took and how difficult it was to get the claim, In 78, they re-amended the act and required all the claims to be redone, everybody to be re-examined. Then in 1981, they amended the act again and made it once again very, very, very difficult to get these. So from 1981 forward, this black lung program, they approved like 5 to 7% of the claims. It was just terrible. It went on year after year. We represented the black lung associations for the state and the national, went to Washington over and over again, tried in 1992, I think we tried, finally got through Rockefeller and some others in West Virginia. We worked on some amendments to try to make it easier again to get the claims approved. And it passed the House of Representatives, but it didn't get into the Senate. Then, finally, with the help of the United Mine Workers, under this latest Affordable Care Act, believe it or not, under the Obamacare, the Federal Affordable Care Act with UMW, at the end, they got a little provision in there that restored the 15-year presumption for coal miners. If you've been in the mines 15 years, you have a breathing impairment, it's presumed to be black lung. Puts the burden on the coal operator to show that it's not black lung. So it's been a terrific help. So we've been doing a lot of these cases under this new for coal miners in the last few years. For some reason, the private bar is not doing them. And that's been a big help. And one of our worries right now under the Affordable Care Act with Trump, if they repeal that Affordable Care Act and don't save that provision that had 15-year presumption, it'll be very hard on coal miners. I've contacted Congressman Rogers about that already, but we'll have to see what happens. In any event, this black lung work, we have seen that at Apple Red and at the Citizens Law Center as a really important area to try to help coal miners and disabled miners and widows. There was also another, for several years during this period, if you were the widow of a coal miner and the miner died, you had to, instead of being able to get his benefits, the widow had to start all over again from scratch from 1981 forward until, I think, 3 years ago, we finally got that changed. Congressman Ray Hall helped get, he tried for several years, finally got that provision in so that if a coal miner died, his widow would get benefits without having to reprove it from scratch. It was awful. It was just heartless to have a provision like that. So that was the companion to this particular black lung effort for Apple Red. The other thing we learned when you think about the United Mine Workers funds and their history is we ended up getting these folks, these disabled miners coming in here saying, I worked for 20 years for coal company A, B, or C back in 1940, 50, 60, trying to get their pensions from the United Mine Workers retirement funds. And the funds were turning these people down because they had these very restrictive provisions. Got to work 20 out of 30 years. The last 5 years have to be with the signatory mine. It was these very restrictive mining pensions. So we end up having all these cases against the mine workers' funds, the separate funds. The funds had been set up way back in 1950 with these very restrictions in them. Now, then there was this case called Blankenship versus Boyle, and Tony Boyle was president in the Blankenship case. In that case, they proved that the mine workers who had set it up were not investing the money for the benefit of the coal miners. So Blankenship, the end of that was that they ended up having to put in, again, the UMWA had to put in a bunch of money to make the mine workers' retirement fund solvent. We weren't in that case, but we found ourselves with all these miners who had worked years and years. And the problem was they'd go apply for a pension. They'd say, we worked in all these places. And the UMW would say, the funds would say, but we don't have any record that that company ever existed. There's nothing in our records that shows they were there. Some company before, see, and most of their records were based on Social Security. And Social Security started in 1937. Because we said, if you win a Social Security award, you'd be eligible, you should be able to get your UMWA pension. Was it was like a little game. You'd have to, more than a game. So they started going back into their records and finding check stubs. And we had law students here for the summer, and even some non-law students going out to Mud Creek and going to these places and looking for some record that this particular coal operator actually had an operation here, and that some, there was some evidence that they were there, so this coal miner could prove he could start putting these years together. And we produced a manual on how to do these claims. And I wrote an article with my deputy called in a coal volume book for lawyers on how to do on pension claims. But this was kind of went along with the black lung stuff. I mean, these were men who'd worked 20, 30 years in the coal mine. And then we had one case, Mike, that went to the United States Supreme Court. We had a widow, we filed a class action. We had a widow named Gracie Robinson who lived up here in Auxerre, outside of Prestonburg. Her husband had more than the number of years necessary to get a pension, to file for his pension. But he decided he wanted to keep working. So he kept on working, but he had never applied for a pension. So when he died, Gracie applied as a widow for widow's benefits based on his 30 years. And they said, he never applied for a pension. You can't get that. You can't get that. But you can't. He, in order to get a pension, he has to apply for it. So we filed a class action. And we lost in the district court. But the Court of Appeals, we filed it in Washington, D.C., for a class of widows. And the Court of Appeals in Washington reversed and said, yeah, that's arbitrary. That's not pension law. You can't just, this man would have applied for a pension. That's wrong. They appealed. The union, the United Mine Workers, and the coal companies appealed to the Supreme Court. And we lost. The court said, tough luck. This is a provision that the mine workers and the coal operators collectively bargained for in the collective bargaining agreement. It's in those years, that's what they said was the bargain, that's what they said, and we're not going to look behind that. So Gracie lost, and what happened, she got a small death benefit. So then in 1974, the law, pension law changed to under the what's called ERISA, the Employment Retirement Income Security Act. And ERISA basically said if you've got, says that pensions are vested after so many years, you can have whatever provision you want, but after so many years, they start vesting. You can't deprive, and so it, ERISA came in with a lot of rules that changed and also changed the death benefit. He would have clearly applied it. Gracie would have won under ERISA, under the new pension plan that they changed in 1974. And since ERISA was in, we haven't had that much pension work, but we spent a lot of time on coal miners' pensions here and became really sort of experts in the field and helped a lot of individual miners, some with really sad stories. I mean, there were these restrictions. We had a guy who had, let's say, 19 and three quarters years instead of 20. And he just had to prove that little, find proof for those other 3 or 4 months to get him over to 20. We kept working and working, looking for that extra 3 months. And I think in one case, I forgot who found it, where the evidence was of those other 3 months. And there was a case involving an owner at one point, a fellow who had a small mine, who worked the mine and who paid into the funds. And there was a big argument about whether, because he'd been an owner, whether he qualified as a classified employee. He'd paid in year after year after year after year. At the tail end, they didn't want to give him his pension because they said he was an owner. There were just a whole series of these cases. So anyway, I think you don't see many of those now, but I'm very proud of the work that our folks did on both in these miners' pension and the Black Lung area. And of course, we were very close to a lot of these people who were like Bill Worthington and some of these Hobart Grills and the people in Harlan County, and worked very closely with these Black Lung chapters. There's a Black Lung chapter now in Letcher County that we've been working with. People are very concerned about what's going on now. Of course, you know, in the last few years with these coal miners, the incidence of Black Lung has actually been going up, even though the mines are supposed to be getting safer, the deep mines.
Where did they find it? Upper Big Branch, when they did the
right
post-death exams, they found these young miners with advanced cases of Black Lung.
Pneumoconiosis.
Yeah, pneumoconiosis.
They did.
What did that tell you?
Yeah. Well, Upper Big Branch, they didn't care. They weren't doing very much about safety or the way they ran that mine, right? A terrible situation. We've had some of those situations here.
Did you ever think they'd get blanket chip on that?
Well, I think the government went after him. They kept going one step higher, and they finally put a case together. Of course, he's just put out all this. I think I had mixed feelings. I mean, on the one hand, it wasn't a very heavy sentence, but on the other, at least they got him. And then I heard somebody, he recently produced his own version. He recently released a book, right? In which he continues to tell the story from a different perspective. He's willing to put money out there to try to do it, but it's terrible. Well, you know, the same with the Martin County spill. When Tony was working on, he talked to you about when they were writing that report. Well, Jack Spadaro was on the report, right?
Yeah.
That's his story. That Martin County spill was terrible. I never forget being up there when we went, the first time we went there and drove up on the way out, and you drove up and looked down on that big sea of sludge far as you could see. We had a damage case. The firm that I went to be of counsel with, Ned Pillersdorf, and we sued the coal company for a group of those people whose land had been destroyed and whose homes had been so badly affected. And you could see where they just wouldn't stop. That thing didn't have to happen, but they decided they wanted to keep on mining a little more than the plan originally that they put in their plan. And so they went too far and the thing broke a few years later. Terrible. I think our mining work has been, you know, and so we, as I say, now we moved a lot of the coal work from Appleread here, from the poverty law firm over to the Citizens Law Center, and we have this building. And a few years ago, I don't know whether anybody mentioned this book of Gray Mountain to you, the John Grisham novel, Gray Mountain. I had met him in Washington when we started talking about mountaintop removal. And I knew that he was interested in it, and that he said he'd eventually get, he'd been thinking about a book about that. And so he eventually came down, and two of the lawyers at, by that, and from our Whitesburg office drove him around for a couple of days in southwestern, in our, in southwestern Virginia and around Whitesburg in the coal mining areas where we were, and talked to him about Black Lung. And then he went back, and when he wrote his book, he called back several times to be sure that what he was writing about Black Lung in Gray Mountain was accurate. Then he wrote a little nice little afterword in the book about the law center and the one
how
in North Carolina.
How helpful everybody had been.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And some people went, they didn't really say any more except the name of the group. And but people who read the book went online and identified who we were, and we got quite a few little checks from individuals. There's no address in there, no website. He just said thank you to us and the group in North Carolina. And a number of people sent some money in.
Wow, great.
Wasn't that nice?
Yeah.
I think they're
did
doing...
Did you like the book?
I did. I wrote a review of it for the Legal Services Management Group. And talked a little about Applerid's work. I mean, I think it was a Grisham book. I didn't know if it really, when you read it, you kind of wondered if he was going to write a follow-up, because it kind of left you hanging a little at the end. But I thought it was good. I mean, I thought he did a nice job, and that it might have been a little over the top in some places, but I thought the description of the legal aid things were good. And all in all, he characterized it. I thought it was a nice plot. Did you read it?
Yeah. I couldn't put it down.
One of our board members for ACLC board was not as happy with it. I'm not sure whether he thought it was, he just overdid it, but I thought I liked the book. Yeah, I thought he did a good job. And we see that going on. I hope that this Black Lung bill is not going to go in the wrong direction. I mean, I hope that we can save that provision. But we've been...
In Obamacare?
Yeah. Yeah. I believe they may have to... Yeah.
That's going to be tough to say.
Yeah, I think it'll have to be some separate... You know, whatever they do with it will probably be done in various pieces, but somehow it'll have to get moved. It's not formally part of the original Black Lung work. I mean, it's part of the ACA. I'm sure it's references the Black Lung Bill, but it's part of that. And so if they repeal the whole thing, it would be part of that repeal. I don't know.
Mr. Trump needs to remember how loyal his West Virginia supporters were, more than a higher percentage than any other state. Although I think if it was just Eastern Kentucky, that we'd have had a... I think Kentucky might have even come out ahead on Trump support. But
yeah, this county was... I mean, he did very well in Kentucky.
Yeah.
He did very well in Eastern... And in here, and we lost this... You know, our house in our... Kentucky was the only southern state left where the House and Senate were divided. So we had a Democratic House and a Republican Senate. And the House was a real bulwark, was still pretty progressive. And the Speaker of the House was from here, a lawyer named Greg Stumbo, who'd been in the legislature 36 years. In the middle, he had become Attorney General for one term, came back and ran for the House again and won. Hmm. So he was in, but he lost to a Republican lawyer here, and so the House flipped. This now is going to be Republican. They go into office the first of the year by a fairly strong majority, much more than it was. Yeah, so we have a lot of work to do. And
so if Trump goes messing with Obamacare, these people who were the most loyal to him are going to suffer unbelievably. There's some figures recently in the Gazette, Charleston Gazette about how many thousands of people are going to suddenly be without.
Well, there's this pension thing that McConnell, you know, there's this whole miners' pension shortfall that Patriot Coal and these other two coal companies have declared bankruptcy. There are like 12,000 miners, unless Congress does something in the next two, between now and the end of the year, they're going to stop paying their pensions. Besides the overall fund, they've already been notified, apparently, from those three bankruptcies that they're going to lose their pensions this fall, unless this McConnell hasn't let it come to the floor. And our second other senator, Paul, said he's against it because of it's the only industry and it ought to be, he said, we ought to fix it with, we should fix it so this doesn't happen, you know, whatever that means, that the coal companies need to be putting enough money into the system. But, and then there's the other folks who say, well, if you do it here, you're going to have to do it for the other industries. But these folks have been paying into, I mean, the coal companies, I mean, they are owed these pensions. And it's horrific, but I don't know what's going to happen there. Whether Trump, I mean, it's, right now it's stuck in the Senate. I think the House has already passed it. I'm not sure. That's a terrible thing.
Sits on a lot of stuff, I think.
But working people, I think in Kentucky they'll probably pass right to work. But does West Virginia have it? No. Have a right to work law?
I think it passed briefly and then it was reversed or something. It's right on the edge.
Yeah, I was trying to think. When we... Yeah, I was going to mention one of the other really nice things the lawyers in my program did way at the beginning and on the mining thing was to sort of save the Red River Gorge. We had it was a huge effort spearheaded by our congressman, Carl Perkins. He thought dams were a big generator of economic development and helped the local economy. And so there was always a lot of flooding in that area around the Red River Gorge when you had heavy rainfalls. So there was a proposal to put a dam in that area that would have obliterated a lot of the Red River Gorge area. And so the initial effort to stop it, we filed it was an Apple Red lawsuit to enjoin that. Of course, Congressman Perkins went off the deep end, but, you know, we'd had Justice Douglas had led a march down here just to save the gorge. And there was then the litigation got started, and then the new governor that was going to come in, there were some private attorneys to help with the lawsuit. A lot of citizens, grassroots lobbying, a lot of work out of our Lexington office. The Lexington office, which I eventually opened, which we often have law students there. Generally, we always did a lot of our environmental work out of the Lexington office for several years. There were a group of lawyers, one of them, and almost all of them, many of them stayed in public interest work. Young lawyer named Tom Fitzgerald, who now runs something called the Kentucky Resources Council in Louisville, does a lot of environmental work himself, teaches part-time at the University of Louisville, worked for us. Two of the lawyers you know in West Virginia, Chuck DeSalvo and Bob Basters, who teach at the University of West Virginia at the law school, worked in our Barberville office for several years. They were both directing attorneys. Bob ran for the Supreme Court a few years ago. Wife's name's Barbara Fleischauer. She's in your legislature.
Okay, yeah.
And he ran for the Supreme Court. He lost, but he kept that other guy and forgot who the third person was on the barrel. It was a few years ago, maybe 10 years ago. Both of them do a lot of litigation still. In fact, I think Bob was involved in this pension case. I have another lawyer, John McFerrin. You know John? He writes for the West Virginia Conservancy. He and his wife practiced in Beckley, but now his wife is a administrative law judge, and they've moved to Morgantown. But he writes for the Conservancy, and he's a really fine lawyer. He had unfortunately had a liver transplant a few years ago, and so he watches the kids. But but the Red River Gorge action, so the new incoming governor, Carroll, was not disposed to fund that project, and so it died after a couple of years. But it was a really good, I was reading a newspaper clipping in which my friend Steve Bright, who does death penalty work for the Southern Poverty Law Center, who worked for us also in the early, late 70s, middle 70s, said, Apple Red saved the Red River Gorge. So it wasn't just us by ourselves, it was a big effort, but we were right in the middle of it, and we filed the case to try to stop it. I'm real proud of that. But the environmental work and the black lung work and these coal companies. And then after that, I think I mentioned we got this funding set up, the Law Center. So then when I retired in 2002, I became the of counsel to a local firm, and a local law firm named, the senior partner's a fellow named Ned Pillersdorf. He was a public defender here when he first came, about 1980 or so, or maybe earlier. But there are three lawyers. But when I went there, I did some environmental work with him, and we started doing some damage cases. And one of the early ones was this Harless County case I was telling you about, the Harless Creek in Pike County, where the Division of Reclamation was looking the other way. There was a coal company up there, which was owned by this guy in Martin County. And their permit expired, and they kept on mining. And they were behind on their reclamation, and so there was a very unusual heavy rain, and it flooded, and we proved, I think, pretty well that flooding was the result of their failure to reclaim that area, and the flood came right down this holler and washed away a couple of houses and washed over some cars and just a terrible mess. And so we sued them, eventually sued the mining inspector, because one of the mining inspectors had not, because they hadn't renewed the permit, and the mining inspector clearly were not. They had sent this outfit a letter saying your permit's going to expire, and if you don't renew it, we're going to have to make you stop mining. They had the notice of the permit, but they didn't stop. They went on, kept on mining. And I think we finally settled the case. Ned finally settled the case. But then he had, as a result of that, he did three or four other cases where communities were flooding. One over in Knox County near Barberville. Terrible situation where somebody actually got killed in one of the floods, washed away. There was two of them there, and there was one in Breathitt County. There was a flooding situation like that in Breathitt County. I've forgotten the name of the community where, but Ned developed a pretty good way of getting local committee together to represent the group that had been affected. And we had four or five of those cases. The office doesn't do any black lung work. Now, I don't know that this is, but so I helped him with a number of those cases. And I didn't do any of the primarily the Harless case. But that's sort of where we are. We've been involved here lately, for the last year, over a year, in this huge effort, which is tangential to the mining. A lot of our clients think are coal miners, but where a lot of people who applied for Social Security benefits went to a lawyer up here named Eric Kahn, C-O-N-N. They got conned by Eric Kahn. And Eric was did Social Security work. And over a period of about 15 years, he made $20 million in Social Security fees from clients. Well, that wasn't fast enough for him. So he had about 1,800 of these people who came to him, and Social Security, 7 years later, said, these people got their claims through Kahn. He represented you in a bogus way. He and a administrative law judge and the doctors who examined you were in a conspiracy. And they conspired to give you benefits whether you deserved them or not. And so you're going to have to reprove the fact that you were disabled 8 years ago when you went to Kahn, or you're going to lose your benefits. And you can't use any of the doctor reports that we say were involved in the conspiracy. And if you have some records to prove this, you send them to us in 10 days. That you were disabled back then, but now you can't use those four doctors. So they finally agreed to extend the 10 days, but 1,800 people. They finally reduced that number to 1,500. They sent them notices that they were going to lose their, if they didn't, that they were under suspect here and that they're going to have to redo these claims from scratch. And two of the folks who got notices committed suicide, killed themselves. They were clients, and one of them was Ned's client in another situation. He called him and said, I just got this notice. Next day he shot himself. And another lady did the same. So we had to find, Eric Kahn had gotten fees for these cases. So all these people had to go through hearings all over again to prove, if they could, to prove that they were disabled way back at the beginning without using these doctor reports. So I got busy. I had served on an American Bar Association committee that tries to promote pro bono help from private attorneys. And we have a project, part of Appleread downstairs is where we have what we call a pro bono coordinator, who's a woman who recruits lawyers to do cases for free from private attorneys for cases like divorces and other things that Appleread just can't get to, or the overflow. Make a long story short, we recruited 135 lawyers from all over the United States to help do these hearings for these people for free, primarily by video. So the lawyers in California, the client is in our local office, and the judge is on video, and the judge is in St. Louis on a video screen. So the lawyer in California has to get the client and interview the client by telephone, by video or telephone or Skype here in the Appleread office. And because that's how they meet their client. And then to do the hearing, to talk to them about being disabled. They're very time-consuming cases. So we had to do a training session. And many of these are lawyers who've done some Social Security offices. I mention this because it's been a terribly time, and Appleread has probably a couple of hundred of these cases in its offices. Because in every one of these situations, some of these people were on SSI, Social Supplemental Security Income. In an SSI case, they can't cut you off. They've got to give you a hearing before they can reduce your benefits because it's basically a welfare program based on your income and your disability. But most of these other people, like you or me, were people who were disabled based on they'd been working. So they'd worked the number of quarters to be eligible, and that benefit is substantially more, probably 1,500 to 1,500 a month, whereas SSI pays 700 a month. So we get a lawyer. So now we're over a year later. This started last May 2016. So now about half of these people, about 800, were able to demonstrate at the hearing. We were able to demonstrate sufficiently to the judge that they were disabled back then to continue their benefits. But about 700 were not able to do that. So their benefits are being cut off, and they're having to appeal to federal court. Now we're trying to find lawyers to go to federal court. In the meantime, we have all these court challenges. So we had a federal, we filed a federal court challenge a year ago with Ned and a group of us, and that judge threw us out for legal jurisdictional reasons. Now we're a year later, and he said, you've got to send these people through the administrative process before I will look at it. They've got to go through their hearings. We wanted to stop it at that initial point and said, this is wrong the way they're doing it. Because we said, you can't just say, you're not going to look at these four doctor reports. You got to give people notice. If you think there's fault here, that they've been, the legal reason for this, doing this, is that there's a statute that says if Social Security feels benefits have been given based on fault or reasonable ground to believe there's fault, they've got to stop them. Well, they decided based on an internal inspector general report that there was fault, but there's been no proof that any of these 1,500 people were involved in the fault. They're just innocent victims here. If there's fault, it was because Eric Kahn and this administrative law judge had a little conspiracy themselves, decided to speed up the process together. They never had a hearing. Each week or each month, the administrative law judge would tell Eric, send me these 30 cases and I'll approve them. And that's what Eric would get these doctors in, and he would oftentimes write up a report ahead of time. Sometimes they would approve them, but most of the clients said they had very extensive interviews with the doctor. Whatever they did, but nobody has a chance here to prove what happened at that time. The only thing we know is we've got 135 lawyers. None of the lawyers have complained that these folks were trying to put something over on anybody or that they weren't disabled. Some are not able to prove they were disabled back then. Many of them are disabled today, and we've had them reapply from scratch, but they won't be eligible for their work quarters that they had originally. So we've got to try to keep those claims alive. So now we have several of these cases in federal court with different judges. It's very complicated. But I'm very proud of all these private attorneys who came forward and were willing to do this for free. Now, Ned, our law firm, he's got a case against Eric Kahn. We don't know whether he had malpractice. The first, there was no malpractice insurance. The government has now indicted Mr. Kahn.
Oh, good.
And the law judge, and the doctor, two of the doctors, one of them died. One of them, who they indicted, they claim, has done medical reports for Social Security. And they use his report, but they won't let us use the reports in these cases. But this has been a huge effort. I mean, some of these folks were coal miners. In fact, the very first black lung client I ever had was applying for Social Security benefits based on his black lung disease. So a lot of these people also had, I mean, we're talking about the same population. Almost all of these clients were from this county and the next county. Some of them, then there are a few that are up in West Virginia. And we've actually filed a lawsuit in West Virginia in Judge Chambers' court up there in Huntington on the same issue. And he didn't want having to do it. He wrote an opinion, an early opinion, which was negative, which we've tried to re-engineer again in front of him with a class action. But I mention it because there wouldn't have been anybody to do this if legal services weren't here, if Appelred weren't here to take the cases and to refer them out, look for lawyers all over the United States. I spent a lot of time recruiting, calling lawyers myself. And Ned, our office, has 40 of these cases. He's done 40 of these hearings and 20 of the cases in federal court. We got a lawyer in Norfolk, Virginia, 8 hours from here, who's did 50 hearings himself. He's been to Prestonsburg twice. He drove here twice. He's filed federal court cases. I'm on several of his cases as local counsel. I mean, he was so upset by this whole situation. So I nominated him for an ABA award. And he got an award from the American Bar Association for his voluntary work. But been remarkable, which is really, you know, says a lot about the profession, about these lawyers who've been willing to do this. But a terrible thing for the clients, as many as 700 people right now who are probably going to lose their benefits. One of the federal judges has now agreed, has said, the way that you are handling the hearings without proving that there is fault, without showing people the reason for your decision that there's fault, this is worse. He said even this client who was in the terrorist case, we accuse this guy of being a terrorist. The Supreme Court said he's entitled to know the evidence against him. He put this in an opinion. He said, but these are Social Security clients, and you won't tell them, you won't let them show them the evidence against them. So he said, this is unconstitutional, the way you're doing it. Now, a couple of the other federal judges have said, oh, he's wrong. The process is in the statute. So we have these conflicting cases that will be probably going to court for the next couple of years.
How do you ever sleep at night? Not
well.
My God, I have to worry about all this?
Well, Ned's got the case. Right now I'm not into as many of these cases, but it is enough to keep you going, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, all of these cases are, so.
Why would somebody from Richmond, does Virginia not have human rights issues of its own? I mean, why would somebody from Richmond?
Norfolk.
From Norfolk get interested in some poor
climate? Well, I mean, there is a group, there's a national organization called the National Organization for Social Security Representatives, just a national group for lawyers and some non-lawyers who do largely Social Security work. And they helped us. I mean, I called them initially, the woman who was their director, because they have a big network of people who have this expertise. We did, and they helped us, and John, his name's John Goss, helped us. He came out of law school, he was a legal aid lawyer, and then went into private practice. He did legal aid for the first few years when he came out of law school. And I think that the condition just spoke to him that this is an area that he has some knowledge about, and that these people are in trouble, and we needed help with training. There are not that many lawyers in Eastern Kentucky. There are lawyers in Eastern Kentucky who do Social Security work. Most of them felt Eric Kahn took away their business. They didn't want to help, and there were no fees. This all had to be done for free, pro bono work, and they were trying to make money. There are a few firms who helped us here. There are two or three lawyers who are still helping us and who are involved in federal court. That's the reason for somebody like John. There's a lawyer down in I found a lawyer in Virginia. There was a lawyer in Atlanta, Georgia, or in Decatur, Georgia. And so we did a training. We've done two trainings at the University of Kentucky in their courtroom, an all-day affair, how to work on these cases and the legal issues that are involved with them. And they're on the AppleRed website so that new lawyers can look at them. Somebody who's interested can get the training and the materials. Wow. So Rob, so that's helpful. But that was John Goss's motivation, I think, was just, this is something I know how to do and my firm can pick up some of my work. He's doing it in addition. He's a very busy lawyer. There are four lawyers that it's a work busy firm, and he's no youngster. Well, John's probably 60. So there are some others around the country. I mean, we spread out. There were a couple of lawyers in Louisville who take 20 and 30 cases. There was a lawyer who's a president of the Bar Association who's retired in Kentucky, never did a Social Security case in his life, looked at the training and worked at it and took one of these cases, spent a lot of time on it, won his hearing, was very proud. And we had the Courier did a nice little article about all these volunteers in Kentucky and about what AppleRed was doing. There's actually been an AP reporter who's been here many, many times, who has interviewed Ned many times. And we've had some public meetings about this at the courthouse where a lot of the people have come together to talk, say what we're doing. And he has a Facebook page that he's been regularly reporting to about this situation. People look at his Facebook page. So he's had a lot of publicity about it, done some recruiting. But it's been a really... there are probably 100 cases in AppleRed right now that are going to have to make their way to federal court. And they're very time-consuming because you have to go through these big transcripts. You have to look at the medical evidence. You have to really understand the medical evidence to show that they were disabled back then, or even if they're disabled, when you go to the hearing. And, of course, Ned likes to argue with these people and go to tell the judge why this is all illegal. So if you get a chance, we'll get a chance to meet him. But that just sort of, and the Appalachian Citizens Law Center, as I said, they're doing some really good work. We do a lot of black lung work and a lot of mind safety work. If you saw Wes, if you interviewed Tony there in Whitesburg, did you meet Wes Addington? He's done a number of the cases with Tony and some without him.
Yeah, I'm really hot to interview Wes Addington.
Yeah,
I'll get back over there one of these days.
Yeah, he's not Addington Mining.
No.
No, he's from Neon.
Was the con guy, was he a local Kentucky guy?
Yeah, grew up here, Floyd County. Made a lot of money, lives in Betsy Lane. And during now that the government has indicted him and claimed that he has deprived, that he, they're claiming that, of course, not only his attorney fees, but that some of these folks got their benefits illegally. So they have a big lien on his, whatever he's got, if he's convicted. Now, the fact that half of these people so far have kept their benefits, I'm sure will be part of his defense. And, but he's got, and he paid, somebody said he paid a lawyer in Washington almost $1 million or so last year. His trial is set for next year. Now, in the meantime, one of the other little stories in this is that at one point, what happened, there were a couple of the employees of the Social Security Administration were complained about this stuff going on. They saw the law judge, Khan's friend, would go into the office early, and he would pick the cases that he would, from the other judges. He would go through the docket and pick out the cases he wanted and send them to Eric Andrus. I think Andrus may have been the chief judge. Anyway, he would pick those cases out. So they started complaining. They complained that this thing between Eric Kahn and his ALJ was going on. They complained to the chief judge, but he wouldn't, and he didn't want to do anything. And so Eric said, "Well, I think let's figure out how we can discourage this person. We'll intimidate her. One of the things we can do, I know that she's allowed to work at home one day a week or something. We'll follow her around and probably we'll show that when she goes to the grocery store, when she's supposed to be working, or that she's going to, we'll follow her around with a video camera and we'll be able to put something together that shows that she's cheating." So they put this little scheme into effect. Of course, it turned out the video was sent to the wrong person. It turned out they were totally wrong. But the scheme was nevertheless in scheme to, with the intention of intimidating her as a whistleblower. So the government indicted, charged the ALJ and Eric with this, about this scheme. And the judge pleaded guilty in federal court recently for doing this. This is the chief administrative law judge in Huntington at the time. So this thing's bizarre. So Ned actually hired one of the Kahn secretaries who used to do a lot of the work for him, is now working in our office up here. I say our office because I don't do that much there anymore, but I still go there regularly.
And I think it's okay for you to say our office.
Yeah, I think they probably claim me. People often call me there. And now Ned is the chair. He's also the chair of the David School Board. I'll take you out to David. It really is an interesting community to see. And that in this New York Times article begins with the David work. And it's really, really very, very heartwarming to see what they're able to do. Those kids would not be in school for any other reason. Is there anything, what else? I don't know if there's anything. I think we've probably, the ACLC, I hope we can keep, you know, the trick of the group like ACLC is to keep it funded because we don't get any government funds. So attorney fees, and donations, and funding from foundations. We've been very fortunate to be able to keep that going. Yeah. I mean, I was the chair for many years, and I stepped down a few years ago, 2 or 3 years ago. So Mimi Pickering, who's at Apple Shop, is our chair right now.
Oh, she is.
Yeah. And, you know, her husband runs this Center for Rural Strategies that at D. Davis at Apple Shop. I mean, at the center. They're in a lot of stuff going on at Whitesburg now. Oh, yeah. You know, they have this nice new artisan center in Hindman. There's a nice story about it today in the Herald Leader.
I haven't seen it.
Yeah, you'd like it. They make dulcimers. They have there's a name for whatever you call those places that make dulcimers.
Huh.
It's in the paper today. Do you play dulcimer?
No, guitar is all I play.
But, well, you've got enough, I think, for me for now, I hope. Oh, it's after 4:00.